Hey there, listeners. This is Josh. Before I let you dive into today's episode, I want to take a moment to provide a brief content disclaimer. A Tale of Two Cities is a musical adaptation based on the classic novel of the same name by Charles Dickens. As such, it touches on heavy themes and subject matter, including physical, sexual, and collective violence, child death, confinement, and alcoholism, as well as brief but graphic descriptions of murder and public executions. While we aimed to discuss these aspects with sensitivity, we understand that some listeners may find these topics disturbing, and that this episode may not be suitable for listeners of all ages. We encourage our audience to approach this episode with awareness of its content and to prioritize their own well-being. Thanks for your understanding, and we hope you enjoy the episode.
Welcome back to Thanks for Participating, your favorite podcast, where we introduce the other person to something that we enjoy and hope that they like it just as much as we do. My name's Sydney, and this is my co-host slash husband, Josh.
How bold of you to assume that this is my favorite podcast.
I would hope it's your favorite podcast.
It's a lot of work, I will say that.
I know, I'm one to talk, though, because I never actually go back and listen to the podcast.
I made you specifically listen back to the Fearless episode that we did because I went back and inserted so much more audio about the Taylor's version and the vault tracks and stuff. I'm like, I'm doing all of this specifically for Sydney, but she doesn't go back and listen to the episode. So I made you pull it up and listen.
That was basically a Josh solo episode, but it was fun to like hear you go like song by song and talk about your thoughts and stuff.
Okay, sorry. Continue.
No, that was really it.
All right.
Yeah.
Good intro. Now you know, listeners, now you know what we both sound like. I'm Josh. Sydney, say something again.
I'm Sydney, but I already said that.
Yeah, but I'm just giving them a refresher. That's what Sydney sounds like.
Okay, in case they forgot in like the half a second since I last spoke.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right. And this is Thanks for Participating.
Did I not give a good enough introduction?
No, you did. I'm just reiterating, okay. You know? I also want to be part of the show, so.
So I'll give an introduction and then you'll give another introduction.
And then you could reintroduce what I introduced.
I'm good. I think the listeners are thoroughly introduced.
Okay. I just feel like I'm Josh and you're, I don't know if we made that clear yet.
I think they get it.
Okay. Just making sure.
I don't think people think that I'm Josh. Like, I know Sydney is a unisex name and we'll get into that in this episode. But
Right. But just real quick before we move on, I just want to reiterate the show that you're currently listening to is Thanks for Participating. And we are Josh and Sydney. Okay, now we can move on.
Okay, and today we're talking about something that is near and dear to my heart, but apparently it wasn't very near and dear to Josh's.
So. Spoilers!
Yeah. I think with all of the episodes that we've done for the most part, we've enjoyed the other things.
Except for Sharknado. I feel like that was a funny episode because the whole time I was just like, Sid, why do you like this? This is hurting me.
Look, I never said it was good, okay? I just said it was entertaining.
I'm pretty sure you got more enjoyment from seeing how much the movie pained me than you actually got from watching the movie.
Yeah, but this one pained me because this is something that I have really enjoyed for a while.
For a long time.
Yeah.
Ever since when I first met you, you told me about how much this musical means to you.
Yeah, and it's not even that the musical is like the best musical I've ever listened to slash seen. I don't know, I just think it like impacted, it had like such a massive impact on me because of, I don't know, just like the lack of expectations I had going into it when I watched it. And which is like crazy because it was a book that was already out, that's been out for like 150 years, like 200 maybe. But I don't know. Anyways, the musical is A Tale of Two Cities. And I watched this musical the first time when I think I was like 12 or something. And my grandparents had season tickets to this this theater company in the area where we grew up when I was younger. And occasionally they'd ask me if I'd want to go along. So I went and saw plays a lot with them. And this one was the one where they just asked me to come along and asked me if I wanted to. And normally I would only say yes if it was like something that I like knew or was interested in, but I didn't really know anything about Tale of Two Cities. I knew that it was a book by Charles Dickens. I hadn't read it yet, and I don't know why they asked me, and I don't know why I said yes, but I did, and I ended up going, and I was so surprised with how much I loved it. I mean, the music is great, but I knew nothing about the storyline, and the story just had such a deep impact on me, and I know it had an impact on my grandparents because I turned and like all three of us were just like crying watching it for the first time. But anyways, it is something that I've introduced other people to, not just Josh, but I was so excited because like our area does this musical a lot. There's several theater companies that I think kind of do it more than like the rest of the country. And so I was just kind of waiting for like another, like a theater company to do it again. And we just happened to drive by this theater.
When we were going to the hockey game.
Yeah, when we were going to a hockey game, we drove by this theater and I saw that they were doing it and it was closing weekend. And so I was like, okay, Josh, like we're getting tickets. We're going to go see this finally.
We literally were just driving down the road and I was being your passenger princess and you were in the driver's seat and you whipped your head around in my direction while you're still driving and you screamed like, they're doing the Tale of Two Cities? And just like, I was so scared. I was like, I thought we were just like, you were shocked and like screaming all of a sudden while you were driving. And I thought we were about to die. I was like so nervous.
I seem to do that a lot to you when we're in the car. Like, I'll be like, and you'll think that we're about to get hit or something. And really, it's just like, oh, this restaurant opened up.
Yeah.
Or like something completely inconsequential like that.
That's okay. And so you immediately like, did you buy tickets like before you went into the game or?
I think it was after when we were waiting to like get out of our parking spot.
Gotcha.
But yeah, I'm just going to like right up top, we're going to spoil this. If you have not seen it, if you don't want it to be spoiled and you have any intention of like reading the book or something, there is kind of a twist at the end. We're going to spoil it. Like, just proceed with caution in this episode.
I do think the statute of limitations for spoilers for the novel, at least, has passed. When did the novel come out?
It came out, let me look it up.
1859.
Yeah, so it's been
165 years.
Yeah, and it is a classic, and a lot of people read it in high school. So I know at my high school, they read it in the honors English class.
Yeah, that being said, I had never read it before.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because, so on a previous episode, as we're recording, it is yet unreleased, and I'm not sure if we will release it before or after we release this episode, but we were talking about in preparation of going to see this, and I have had mixed success at going to see productions, concerts, musicals, things like that, because I have kind of like a sensory processing difficulty, especially like auditory processing, where it's hard for me to take in music and lyrics and story and all of the things at once. And so like I remember going to see The Music Man for the first time. I left having no idea what happened, who any of the characters were. And so I was nervous. And like when Sydney takes me to concerts, the first several times I had pretty negative experiences because I would just get overstimulated and I wasn't familiar enough with the music. But recently, I feel like it's a strength that I've kind of built up, mainly thanks to Sydney encouraging me and giving me opportunities to participate. And like, for example, when she showed me the Speak Now album, I got a lot more out of it. I was able to process a lot more of the lyrics, a lot more of the meaning behind the songs. So I asked her, like, do you think I should read the book or at least know what the story of the book is? Or do you think I should listen to the music before I go see it? And I think ultimately I decided to risk it and go in blind, trusting that I would have the skills necessary to follow the story and process the music as we were listening to it. And unfortunately, I was too overconfident in my ability.
Yeah. So I guess you kind of talked about this a little bit, but Josh, why don't you give me your first impressions of seeing the musical?
Okay. My just like overall first impression was almost like confusion and frustration a little bit. And it's a mix of factors. I like for some reason Like, so this, I mean, I'm sure we'll get into it, but like the theater that we saw it was in the round. So the stage was down on the floor, and then it was kind of stadium seats around it. And so at sometimes, and then the entrances. So
I do want to like note real quick, sorry to interrupt you, but this was actually the theater that I saw it in when I saw it the first time. And I've seen it, I think that was the third time I've seen it, maybe the fourth, but like the very first time that I saw it was in that theater. But it was a different theater company that has like since built a new theater that's still in the round.
But it's bigger, right?
But it's bigger. I've only been once since they moved because my grandparents don't have season tickets anymore and my grandpa's dead. But like, so I just don't like have as many opportunities to go as I did when I was younger. But it was a new theater company like moved in to that theater and like did it. So it was kind of full circle moment, I guess, to like...
Full circle because in the round?
Yeah, to like see it back on that stage again.
And it was probably the same director, right?
I don't know. I really can't remember.
When the director came out and introduced the show, and he said, I previously directed this same show back in, what, 2011 or something?
Oh, yeah, it probably was.
And it was probably that time that you saw it.
Yeah, it probably was then. And I think some of the actors that were in it were some of the actors that like used to be at the other theater company when it was there.
Yeah. So anyway, this was the first time I had seen any show in the round like that. And there's parts of the stage and like they're always rotating things around. So there's not really a clear sense of where the front and back is. And also there are entrances like in the aisles 360 degrees. So people are entering and leaving next to you. And sometimes they're on platforms behind you. So there were a couple of times where someone was singing or talking literally standing behind me. So I'd have to tilt my head. And so I think because of that, where I was like constantly moving around, and also the seats were kind of small, where I like didn't like feel super like I had enough space, I was just getting kind of restless and also like a little bit of a headache. And so that really kind of hindered my ability to enjoy what was happening. And then also, I'm pretty sure whoever did the mix for the sound did a poor job, because it was, there wasn't a live band or like orchestra doing the music. It was a recording playing through the speakers, but then also you had the actors singing into their microphones. And like when they were talking with no music, I could understand probably 85% of what they were saying. But as soon as the music came on and they started singing, it was down to like 5 to 10% I could understand. I could barely hear what they were singing. And so, and it was what's sad is that a lot of the story beats, like the plot points, are delivered in the songs.
Yes, there's a lot of exposition in the music for sure.
Yeah, and going into this not knowing what The Tale of Two Cities is about, like I think I knew that it was Charles Dickens, but I thought it was about aliens or something. But I think I think I was just confusing it with, is it War of the Worlds, which is also like a classic like English literature.
Yeah, but that's like H.G. Wells from the 50s.
Hello, listeners. Pardon the interruption. This is Editing Josh from the future. Ooh. Just wanted to clarify that H.G. Wells wrote The War of the Worlds in 1898. Don't know why Sydney thought that it was in the 1950s. She was probably thinking about the radio drama that was in 1938. So a little closer to the 50s, but just thought I would clear that up in case anyone was confused. You'll probably hear me popping in now and then throughout the episode, because neither of us are history majors, but this is a very history-centered podcast, and I just want to offer some tasteful corrections. Did H.G. Wells also do a time machine?
Maybe.
I don't know. I think there's a list of novels that are like considered classics in an AP English a class that I would see lists of, or like when you go to the classic section of the bookstore, you see them all. And I remember seeing Tale of Two Cities there, and I just in my brain put it together with like War of the Worlds or 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea or something.
Yeah.
Wait, I don't even know if that's a book. Is that a book or is that just
20,000 Leagues Under the Sea?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a book.
Okay. Anyway.
So not I didn't by H.G. Wells, though.
I didn't know what this was about, and it was just really difficult for me to follow along. And And then also, just it was really hard for me to even hear what the music was supposed to sound like. And it all led to this really, like, the final scene is this character basically sacrificing himself because of his love for this unrequited love for this other character. And it was this massive, like, climactic thing. And it's like, okay, I could see why when you and your grandparents came to see this, why this moment would, like, bring tears to your eyes. But for me, it just felt like this climax that wasn't earned by the 2 hours that had preceded it, because I just had no idea what had happened and I just didn't feel like it built up to anything. And I really felt guilty feeling that, because I knew, one, I knew how important it was to you, but also because the person who wrote the music was there the performance.
The book and the music. Like, she basically wrote the whole thing.
Yeah, the creator of the musical was in attendance at that performance. And they, like, pointed her out. She, like, wrote it before it went on Broadway, and then it came to Utah. But I was just like, man, I feel bad that I'm having such a negative reaction when the person who made it is right there, like, sitting across from me.
And, like, I just want to note, though, that you made this sound like it was a really terrible production of this musical. And I just want to say that I don't think it was a terrible production. I mean, the mix was not good and it was hard to hear. And obviously, I've seen it multiple times before. I've listened to the music a billion times. So, like, I knew what was going on. And I thought the actors did a really good job. I liked the direction, the staging. Like, I thought it was overall not the, like, it was a good production of it, and it definitely wasn't the worst production of it that I've ever seen. But I think just because of, like, your sensory issues and the mix and not being able to, like, hear what's going on as much, that's probably, like, the main reason why you had, like, such a negative experience to it. But, like, I felt like overall it was a pretty good production.
Yeah, I remember at intermission you looked at me and you could tell, oh, are you not enjoying this? And I'm just like, I don't know. Like, I don't know how to answer. Like, I'm not, because when we went to see Hadestown, that was probably the musical that I had been introduced to and seen the first time prior to going to A Tale of Two Cities. I did not have any issues.
In fact, you cried through the whole first half.
Like, it was very moving. I enjoyed it so much. There was honking outside. I enjoyed Hadestown so much. I'm dying to go back to see it. I was just so moved by it. But I just was not getting anything. Like, it wasn't, like, I was, what was happening in the show wasn't impacting me in any way, really positively or negatively. And so I was just kind of, like, left empty with my reaction to it. And it's that, like, feeling of just, like, empty confusion and not really knowing how to feel, that stuck with me for days after we saw it.
Really?
And I was just, like, pondering, like, what happened? Like, I was trying to figure out if that reaction to the show was due to the actual show itself, or the specific production quality of it, or just my state of mind that night, or what. And I think it just boils down to, like, my difficulty in processing it, and also just my misconceptions going into it. I think you had mentioned that the show starts with a girl. What's the girl's name?
Lucy.
Lucy. And her father, who had been imprisoned for 19 years in the Bastille. 17 years. And then he comes out. And so I'm expecting that the daughter and the father are the main characters of this story. And then it's introduced, there's this French, they're from England, right? And there's this French guy.
No, they're actually French.
Oh.
They're, well, Dr. Manette, who's, like, Lucy's dad, like, him and his wife were French. And so Lucy, obviously, by extension, was French. But when, Dr. Manette's wife died when she was in the Bastille, like, right after he got put in the Bastille. And Lucy was still pretty young when that happened. And at that point, I think his banker, or, like, the manager of his estate,
Mr. Laurie,
was put in charge of Lucy, because, you know, she's, like, part of his estate at that point. And he was English, and so he took her over to London, and Lucy was pretty much raised English, even though, like, she's technically French, by Mrs. Pross. Or Miss Pross, or whatever. But, you know, that lady that was, like her caretaker, raised her in London. And so when Lucy, like, gets Dr. Manette out of the Bastille, they do go over to London.
Right. So just in the beginning, the father comes out of the Bastille, is reunited with the daughter, and then is this love interest, is it Charles Darnay?
Yes.
Is introduced. And right off the bat, I'm like, this is so Les Mis. Like, the father figure in the French Revolution, imprisoned for 17 years, comes out. There's a daughter and a love interest. So
yeah,
I'm like,
but it actually takes place in the French Revolution. Les Mis does not take place during the French Revolution.
When does Les Mis take place?
Like 30 years afterwards, or like 20 or 30 years afterwards, in like a different revolution that was less successful.
Okay. Just, I'm thinking revolutionary era France.
Like, yeah, yeah, yeah.
30 years is like the same to me.
You know, it is very similar vibe.
No, like I've, in my mind, I mean, history is not my strong suit, but it's like the French Revolution is like that whole like time period. And then there's like specific events like the Reign of Terror. And so like Tale of Two Cities is like right up to and like during the Reign of Terror. And then, but like, I always thought that like the events of Les Mis were also technically French Revolution.
No, and that's a common misconception, is that it does take place during the French Revolution. But the French Revolution was like done and resolved. And then like 20, 30 years later, there was like another uprising, and that's when Les Mis takes place. Oh, it's called the June Rebellion. That's what it was. And it actually takes place 50 years later.
So what was I saying?
That it's like similar to Les Mis, giving you similar vibes.
Okay, so a father who was wrongly imprisoned, a daughter and a love interest in Revolution France. I thought that that was going to be the story that we were following, and that it was going to be about, and I thought like, oh, well, the Charles Darnay, this love interest, who is from aristocratic family in France, is going to, and had like left his riches to like go on and like do better things, is going to join the revolution or something. So I'm expecting that kind of aspect. And then after a couple of scenes, there's this other character, Sidney Carton.
Mm-hmm.
Introduced. And he's kind of the assistant, apprentice to a lawyer, because Charles Darnay is framed by his aristocratic uncle to be a French spy in London, right?
Right. And really, he's just trying to escape the aristocrats. And, he's just trying to escape, like, his past and just, like, start fresh. And right. He went to London to do that.
And so the uncle had sent his, like, henchmen with forged spy papers about, like, the British troops. And so he gets arrested. And is it her name Lucy?
Yes.
Okay, Lucy's dad hires this lawyer to, like, help get Charles Darnay acquitted. And that lawyer's apprentice is Sidney Carton. And I was just thinking that Sidney Carton, like, does some tricky shenanigans to basically get the case dismissed and show that henchman witness was not a valid witness or whatever.
Unreliable.
Yeah. And so I was like, okay, that was cool. But then after that scene, he was in every scene after that. And like, I was like, man, they are spending a lot of time on this Sidney guy who like up and like, I didn't think that he was an important character. I just thought that he was some random side character. And I was like, man. And even like he had his own like soliloquy songs.
He has
like
three
like
songs.
Reflection songs where it's like, he's the only one on stage and it's like very emotional and powerful. And I'm just like, who is this guy? Like,
those three songs are my favorite songs in the whole, well, that and Out of Sight, Out of Mind are like my favorites. I mean, he is like basically the main character, so.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying is that yeah. I was like, who is this guy? And then it wasn't until the last scene. So what happens is they go back to France eventually, and that French Revolution Reign of Terror has really taken hold. And because Charles Darnay has the aristocratic background, he gets arrested by the rebellion and is sentenced to death. But then what had been established previously in the show and in the story is that Sidney Carton and Charles Darnay are like look similar to each other. And Sidney Carton, who was in love with Lucy, sacrifices himself and does a switcheroo. And so he goes to the guillotine instead. So in the final scene, he's marching up the steps to the guillotine and says, like, it is a
far, far better
thing that I do than
I've ever done.
It is a better rest that I go to than I've ever known. And I'm just like literally 5 seconds before the final bows, I'm like, wait a second, is this guy the main character of the show?
Yes.
Like, oh my God. Like, I was waiting for more to happen with Lucy and Darnay and the father, which, like, they had, like, certain contributions to the story. It turns out that the reason that the father was imprisoned was because Charles Darnay's uncle had...
Marquis Saint Evremond.
Yeah. And his family had raped and murdered these French peasants. And the lady who's kind of one of the leaders of that rebellion and who had arrested Charles Darnay was the younger sister of those people.
And that's the twist. Yeah. In case you were wondering what the twist was, Josh, that's the twist.
Okay.
The joke is that on the way home, like I had talked about this twist, and then on the way home, we're like driving home and I'm silent and like kind of upset because he clearly didn't like it.
Yeah.
And he was just like, what was the twist? And I'm like more upset because I'm like, you didn't think that was a twist. You didn't think that was good. I didn't realize that he just like didn't comprehend like half the musical. And so I was like so upset.
Okay. Part of the other thing is because it was like a smaller theater with a like, smaller like stage in the round, it was also a smaller ensemble. And so one thing is like halfway through, I was like, wait, this is called A Tale of Two Cities. What the heck are the two cities? Like, and it wasn't until after intermission where I was like, okay, it's like, was it London and Paris?
Yes.
Or it's like England and France, like during this time. But I was just like, what the heck is going on? And then I realized that it's the ensemble, like the same ensemble characters and actors playing the residents of both cities. And also just during other scenes, people would come out and I could tell like, oh, these are the patrons of the bar. Oh, these are the French revolutionaries. Oh, these are the aristocratic people in the court. And so it's just really hard for me to keep track of like where we were supposed to be, what the setting was, because the same ensemble would come out and we were so up close that we could see their faces and it was just like hard for me to keep track. And so what's that lady's name who like knits?
Oh my gosh, now that you ask me, I'm blanking, but she's
Madame Defarge.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she's, you know, that pivotal character.
The villain, so to speak.
And I vaguely remember at the beginning, she was like knitting this like red project. And she said something about like she knits the stories of those who are dead because of the aristocrats or something. Like.
Yeah, she like, with these hands, I keep the memory of the things we've had to bear. I mark the names of who will pay when we are free. I knit a picture of the way it ought to be.
Yeah.
And I think in the book, like the knitting plays like a much bigger role than it does in the musical, but in the musical it's just kind of like there, you know.
Uh-huh. Well, anyways, so I vaguely remember that at the very beginning, her saying that, and then she just kind of like blended in with the ensemble, and it hadn't been established who this character is or that I should remember this lady when she appeared.
So
it wasn't until the trial again, like the second trial towards the end of the show, where she shows up and she sings like, oh, I was the daughter of this, and I'm just like, lady, who are you? Like,
so Monsieur Defarge, her husband, he was an old associate of, oh my gosh, I'm so tired. All the names are like blending together. But Monsieur Defarge was an associate of Dr. Manette before he was put into the Bastille. So I don't know if you remember, but at the very beginning, once he comes out, like him and Madame Defarge are the ones who care for Dr. Manette while Lucy like travels to England or to Paris to go pick him up. And so when Lucy like shows up in Paris, she goes to the Defarge's house and that's where Dr. Manette is being kept.
Gotcha. I did not remember that. I also didn't know that she had a husband in the show.
Yes.
But yeah, so there's that big twist that I just didn't hit with me because it wasn't a character that I knew that had appeared previously in the show. So
yeah, and that was not in a song, I don't think, but it was just like very quickly mentioned. But yeah, like her husband was like the one black guy.
Gotcha. However, a couple of days after we saw it, I was thinking like, so one thing is like, I like the whole drive home, I was thinking, I can't even hum to you the melody of a single one of the songs of the show. None of them were memorable to me, partly because I just couldn't hear any of the words or melody that was being sung, but also partly because the vibes, like obviously this felt very similar thematically, a bit to Les Mis, just like the setting and everything. And in Les Mis, it's a completely sung through musical where there are like big pivotal capital S songs. And then in between them, where you would expect in a musical to be just plain dialogue, that dialogue is also melodically driven, like sung through. And for me, those in between songs that aren't like the memorable big songs felt like what all of the big songs were in Tale of Two Cities. The in-between parts were spoken, and then we're like, okay, here's a big song that we're going to sing. It kind of felt like those in-between songs in Les Mis. And I thought to myself, I feel like if I go see a different production of this show, I might have a different reaction to it. But also, I'm curious, like, if I just listen to the original cast album, what my thoughts will be. And you have the book with, like, all of the music and stuff. Not all of it, but most of the music from the show. And so one night, when I couldn't sleep, I pulled out that book and I opened up the cast album. And then as I was listening to it, I was like reading along with it. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is really moving and powerful.
Yeah.
And really good music. And I was like, and the whole time I was like, I have no memory of this song in the show that I just watched 2 days ago. And then I think I told you in the morning, I'm like, man, if we went and saw it, now that I've heard this music, I think I would like it so much more.
Yeah, so we definitely will be seeing it again because, like I said, I mean, it's not the greatest musical that's ever been written. Like, that's for sure, but it's still a great musical. And I was just so shocked, like, by your reaction afterwards. Like, I was like, I mean, I know it's not, like, you know, it's not Les Mis, and it's not Wicked, and it's not Phantom of the Opera, but it is still, like, a very good musical. Like, it was on Broadway for a reason, and I just couldn't believe that you just didn't like it. And, I mean, the source material that it draws from, like, just narratively, Tale of Two Cities is a great story. And so, like, the source material that it had from Charles Dickens was just incredible. And then the music, I felt like Jill Santoriello does a really, really nice job. And I was just shocked that you had such a negative reaction to it. And it made me really, really sad. And I think we drove home in silence, like, basically the whole way. Like, you tried to ask me a couple of questions, but I just, like, was not in the mood to talk to you because I was, like, so upset.
Yeah. The main two things that would change my experience in seeing this musical, should I see it again, are one, knowing that Sidney Carton is the main character and paying attention to him instead of dismissing him because I thought he was a side character, and two, actually knowing what the music is supposed to sound like. So those two things would be like a double-edged sword, and I would have a completely different experience. So we'll have to seek out another production, go see it, and then record an updated podcast episode where we can let you know my new thoughts and experience.
And our state does this production quite a bit. Like, usually at least every other year, there's some company that does it. Like, I know a few years ago, the company that I originally saw do it was putting it on again, but they're probably the most expensive in the Salt Lake area as far as, like, regional theater goes. And so, you know, we're college students. We had to miss out on that one. But I think, you know, next time it comes around, we're going to have to see it again.
For sure. Definitely.
Okay. Well, I do have a few questions for you. And going through this, I don't know, it's kind of hard because, like, you missed a lot of stuff, like, that first time and you didn't really understand what was going on. But I guess, like, did, like, listening to the music again kind of enrich your understanding of the story and kind of, like, help you figure out, like, what was going on? Or...
Yeah, for sure. Especially being able to read the lyrics with the sheet music, figuring out what was happening. I do, like, so usually, like, in a musical, I like big, high-energy ensemble pieces and the slow, melodic, like, reflective monologue songs are really hard for me to, like, sit through and enjoy. But that being said, like, sitting and, like, reading what is being sung made me really have an appreciation for reflection. Is that the same one as I Can't Recall, or is that a different one?
That's a different one. So reflection is kind of like...
Oh, reflection is the one after he, like, is mean to Charles Darnay in the bar. And
yes.
Then he's realizing, like, wait, why was I that way?
It's like right after he gets Charles Darnay off the first time, and then he invites him out to a drink, and then he's kind of a jerk and like talking gross about women, and Charles Darnay is like offended and leaves. And then I Can't Recall is so him and Charles Darnay, Sydney Carton and Charles Darnay, kind of court Lucy at the same time. And I think Lucy like gives Sydney, and Lucy's obviously like more interested in Charles Darnay, but she's a really nice person and develops a friendship with Sydney. And I think she like gives him a kiss on the cheek, and then he's like, oh my gosh, like, because Sydney Carton is like drunk and just kind of like given up on life and is like, I'm just gonna like be drunk and that's how I'm gonna like get through everything. And she kind of like gives him like a newfound appreciation for life, and that's kind of like what that, when that song comes in.
Yeah, like the lyrics right here, I can't recall a night so clear, the heavens seem an inch away, not cold and empty like before, a night as sweet as this tonight, I can't recall the taste of wine, which is like, he's the kind of primary characteristic of Sydney Carton is that he's an alcoholic.
Yes.
But in this moment, he can't recall the taste of wine. Have I been drinking down my days? A crippled wretch content to crawl. If I have been that man, right now I can't recall. And it's just kind of like this turning point of the character. And I'm like, whoa, this is really potent stuff. Like when I'm like listening and reading, it's like, I just wish that I had the ability to like feel that in the moment when I was listening to it, but I just didn't get it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that's one of the reasons why I was drawn to this musical and why I love it so much. You know, I think we've talked before about the differences between you and I listening to music, that you like more upbeat, like fun stuff. And I'm drawn to like the more reflective, moody, like lyric driven songs. And that's a lot of this musical, has a lot of like the moody, like lyric driven pieces to it. And a lot of that is driven by the character of Sydney, kind of just like his character arc is truly beautiful in a sense, where he just starts as this like alcoholic, he's given up on life and just like hates everything and is just full of so much self-loathing. And he learns to appreciate life and find purpose through his friendship with Lucy and Charles, and later their daughter when she is born. And then by the end, he gives up his life for Charles and for that family because of their love for them, and like finds purpose through, like, because these people had like given him so much and had given him a purpose to life that he like, you know, wants to give back to them and like gives the ultimate sacrifice. And I think like that's just such a beautiful theme that's like shown throughout the musical.
Yeah. The other song is If Dreams Came True, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is, when exactly does he sing this? Is this before he goes to prison or while he's in prison?
This is before. So like after I Can't Recall, when they're kind of courting in Sydney, like Charles Darnay and Lucy are kind of courting, Sydney's like developing a friendship and he's trying to turn it into courting, and he asks her out. And right before, like literally right before he had asked her out, Charles had asked Lucy to marry him.
So this is, okay, I know.
And so,
this is the song where he's kind of singing on that rotating thing. Mm-hmm. And in the middle, you're seeing Charles and Lucy's life develop and they have a daughter together.
Yeah, they get married, they have a daughter.
And so the whole time in the background, their life is progressing and he's just watching them and singing reflection of like this. That makes sense. So the lyrics, if dreams came true, I might have been a better man. If dreams came true, you might have set me free. But God is kind. For you, he had a better plan and saved you from the pain of loving me.
I love that line right there, in just the sense that it just like captures the emotion of everything so well. But it is just like such a gut punch.
Yeah, I do feel there are a lot of themes in this music that listen, like reading it and listening to it now, really resonate with me. Unfortunately, that's something that I deal with, is like kind of that self-loathing and stuff. And like seeing his, like Sydney Carton's progression like through this is just very resonating with feelings that I have and experiences that I have.
I think we all can relate to Sydney Carton in a sense. I mean, even some of us with like the most healthy self-images still have self-loathing at times. And so I think that's another reason why this is such a powerful story, is because like every single person, like regardless of like who you are and how you view yourself, you can relate to Sydney Carton at some point in some sense.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe some more than others, but...
What about, so your other favorite song, Out of Sight, Out of Mind. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so this is that song sung by that random character that
Who I now know is Madame Defarge.
Yes.
Okay.
And it's actually a pretty significant character that Josh just didn't pick up on. But this is kind of, there is a turning point in the musical and in the story where Marquis St. Evremond, who is Charles Darnay's uncle, he is just this callous, like, person. He is concerned, like, callous and self-absorbed person that is concerned with, like, himself and his riches and his power and nothing else. And he is, like, going through the streets and runs over a little boy, just driving so fast. Like, driving his...
carriage?
Let me start that over. Yeah, he's, like, driving his carriage really fast through the streets, and he runs over a little boy. And then he, like, comes out and basically, like, blames the peasants for it and, like, calls them scum and, you know, treats them as less than human. And these, like, feelings of... anger and just like hopelessness had been bubbling up for so long with the peasants that this like death is kind of the turning point where they've been like planning a revolution for a very long time. And, you know, it's been talked about how Madame Defarge is like, you know, keeping the names of everyone that they're going to go after like in this record, but they're just waiting for the right time. And you know, when that boy dies is when they decide like this is the right time that we're going to go after them. And so the father of the boy, his name's Gaspard, is, you know, like really despondent, and like his son is dead. He doesn't care what happens to him anymore. And he's like, now is the time. Like, and Madame Defarge is like, yeah, like let's do it now. And Monsieur Defarge is kind of like hesitant about it. And she's like, what are we waiting for? Like, we've waited for so long. Like, now children are dying. Like it's time. And so she sings this like really powerful song, basically just kind of capturing those feelings of how they've just been waiting in the wings and like building up strength and waiting for the right time. And now's the right time. And at the same time that she's doing that, Gaspard is like climbing up the tower and like going and murdering the Marquis. And it's just such a powerful song. You know, I think a lot of the same feelings that we can relate to right now of how there's just this huge disparity between the rich and the poor, and how the rich and like the ruling elite like clearly don't care about what's happening with the disappearing middle class, and just how everyone is kind of like becoming poorer and poorer, and things are spiraling out of control with inflation. Just kind of these feelings that we can relate to, and how they were just waiting in the wings and like now's the time. And I love the staging of this scene too. I saw it once where they like actually had like a physical tower built on the stage that he was like climbing up, that was like really cool. And this time, like, because it was that smaller theater in the round, it was just, there's like three platforms around the theater, and he just kind of like climbs up the stairs to like one of the platforms that's like the Marquis Tower. But it's just like this really cool, belty, powerful song that I love. What were your kind of first impressions when you listened to it?
Well, when I first saw it in the show, I was like, okay, this is obviously supposed to be a very powerful like plot moment. And it's like this actor who's playing this character is giving her all to this performance right now. And I'm just like, who are you? Like, what are you talking about? It's like, you know, in Finding Nemo, where they're on the East Australian current with the sea turtles, and Crush's little baby turtle Squirt is talking to Marlin and Dory. And what does he say? He's like saying something about how you need to ride the current or something. And he's just so energetic and using all of these like words that they don't understand.
Speak to me, I know it. You know, you're really cute, but I don't know what you're saying.
That's how I felt, where I'm like, Madame Defarge is like giving it all. She's like singing about like what's important right now, and I'm just not understanding a single thing she's saying. And I'm like, it's like she's trying to speak to me. I know it.
For the record, like, the actress we saw did a great job. And she was the same actress that I saw the first time.
Oh, really?
In 2011. Yeah, they mentioned, I think it was in, like, the playbill or something that she had, like, played that role before. And she did a great job. But Josh just was in his own world, I guess.
Yeah. She's, like, emotional. Like, you could see that she's, like, on the verge of tears. And then all of a sudden in the background, oh, that guy just murdered that guy. Like, what? Like, what is going on? And then I kind of pieced together in the a couple scenes later during the dialogue when they're like, oh, they are going after the aristocracy now and decapitating them. I think they had like a showing of, was it King Louis and Marie Antoinette?
Yeah, that was in a later song where they're kind of like mocking the aristocracy.
Yeah, and it shows them like bringing them to the guillotine and anyway.
Yeah, they kind of do like a little like farcical play within the song where they like have people dress up as like caricatures of King Louis VIII and Marie Antoinette. And
yeah. So yeah, that's just like the overarching thought I have is that there was this barrier that was preventing me from getting any true experience from the show the first time. And now I'm just like, oh my gosh, I wish I could just go back, like knowing what I know now about this story, because I just think that this would be so good on the stage.
It is. And that's why I was like telling you, you should listen to it up until the letter, because I don't want you to have the twist spoiled. Kind of, and the letter is like the song where like everything is in, like everything comes together. Like you figure out why Dr. Manette was in the Bastille. You figure out who Madame Defarge really is and her connection. And then they kind of reveal who Charles Darnay is to the rest of the family, because like Charles Darnay had tried to say, hey, just so you know, like I am an Evermond, and Dr. Manette like shut him up and was like, don't tell me and don't tell Lucy. We don't want to know. And
I thought that was the twist that you mentioned. You're like, there's a big twist partway through. And the whole time I'm thinking that the twist you meant was that Darnay was an Evermond. And I'm like, it was like literally his introduction was that he's the nephew of this guy and he took his mother's maiden name, Darnay, instead of Evermond. And I'm like, and it's also clear that Evermond is the one who put Dr. Manette in the Bastille. Like, that's made clear very early on.
Yeah, they, like, hint about it, and, like, you suspect it.
Yeah, and so I thought, like, that was the big twist, and I'm like, that really wasn't a twist. That was made pretty clear from the very beginning. So I thought, so that's why I asked you. I'm like, did you think that was a twist when it turns out that Darnay is Evermond? So.
Yeah, and I was just, like, so mad because I was like, the twist is, like, so clear. Like, it's, I mean, it was a twist that it was, like, revealed to, like, Lucy and Dr. Manette, like, at that, like, critical point. But
yeah, and then Dr. Manette shows up and vouches for Charles Darnay, saying, he's a good man. If he was, like, a corrupt aristocracy, would I have let him marry my daughter? And he almost sways them to let him go. But then Madame Defarge shows up and is like, actually, I have this testimonial that you wrote while you were in the Bastille condemning the Evermonds and all of their family.
Mm-hmm.
And then sways.
And that was the twist.
Yeah.
That I was talking about, that I think is so fantastic and well done. All right. It's hard to like, I have this like list of questions and I want to ask you a bunch of them, but it's hard because like you didn't get the plot the first time through.
But I get the plot pretty like thoroughly now.
So it's like character portrayals, like it's
okay,
hard
one
to...
character portrayal that I actually really enjoyed is I have his name right here. Wait, maybe it's on a different page. The guy who played Barsad, John Barsad.
Is that the lawyer?
No,
that's the crooked guy.
That's the crooked guy, yeah. I thought like he's just like this tall, lanky guy with like
the hair.
Wiry long hair, and he had this like he did this I don't even, you know, I don't know regional British accents very well, but he just did this accent so well.
Was it
just,
Cockney that he did?
It might have been Cockney-esque.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, and it was a different, like all the actors were doing like British accents, but his accent specifically was, you could tell was different, and it made him stand out. And he was just this twisted, like dishonest scoundrel type character. And he just played him so well.
Mm-hmm. He did a really nice job. I mean, I like truly felt like all of the actors did a great job, but I felt like Lucy, she was so sweet and like just the epitome of like everything that I like think of Lucy as. Like I felt like that actress did a very good job of portraying her. And the other one that I really, really loved was the Marquis I thought he did such a good job of just being so slimy and gross and despicable. He also did a really great job. But like I said, I felt like all of the actors did a great job, but those were kind of the two performances that stood out to me.
There was the other side character who was the resurrectionist,
yeah,
as he was called.
Mr. Cruncher.
Yeah, and he was also the bodyguard for Miss Pross, right?
For like Lucy and Miss Pross when they were traveling by themselves.
And that actor, I think he also did a Cockney accent. And and he's also kind of like this, he knew Barsad because of being in like the scoundrel.
Yeah, he kind of operates in the gray area, but I think he operates more on like the good side of the gray area, where like deep down he has like good intentions at heart, but he's like not afraid to do like kind of illegal things. Whereas like Barsad is more like purely out for himself. And like, he's not like a bad guy, but he is like always looking for ways to get ahead, and he's not afraid to like take advantage of other people.
Yeah. So that is the other performance that stood out to me that I was like, okay, this is fun. Like while I was watching was this grave robber character.
Yeah.
So.
Blimey, woman.
Any other questions?
Yeah. I guess just like now that you understand the story, like what are some of the themes of it that like really stuck out to you? And now that you've, I mean, I guess we kind of touched on this, but now that you've like gone through the music, like what stands out to you thematically?
Like obviously the big one is sacrifice, like what you're willing to do for a cause that you believe in, but also for the people that you love. And what's hard is that in, obviously that theme is explored through Sidney Carton's character, and he in the end makes the ultimate sacrifice by giving his life for Charles Darnay, who he had spent the entire show being envious of, because he ended up with the woman that he had fallen in love with instead of Sidney, and then eventually makes the decision to sacrifice his life to save Charles Darnay in order to protect. Like, there's the song Let Her Be a Child.
Yeah.
Where she's singing, like, I think it's like in that moment where he's kind of making the decision, and it's the audience still hasn't figured it out exactly what he's doing, because they kind of still think that he's going to go to prison to ask Charles Darnay permission that after he's dead, if he can then marry the wife. And then it's not revealed until later that he was pulling a switcheroo on Barsad to help him get into prison. And anyway, but in that song, Let Her Be a Child, he's saying that Lucy had to grow up without a father figure because Dr. Manette was in the Bastille, and he doesn't want Lucy's daughter to have to go through the same thing, growing up without a father and a destroyed family because of injustice in the system, them having wrongly executed her father. And so because of that, like, love for Lucy and his almost pseudo-parental love for Lucy's daughter as kind of
also
her...
Also named Lucy.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, her name is Lucy.
As one of her caretakers, that he ultimately decides to give his own life so that this man that he is envious of can return home to them.
I think, you know, obviously Sidney is the ultimate example, but there are a couple of other characters that you see like that aspect of sacrifice in. And that first is Dr. Manette, who obviously sacrificed 17 years of his life and his family to do for his integrity, because like he was the doctor that was called to the scene of the rape and murders after the Marquis basically took this like pretty peasant girl that they just wanted to like have at. And he was the one that was called to take care of them when they were like obviously in bad shape. And the Marquis tries to buy him off, and he refuses the bribe. And honestly, like, I don't know what I would do in that situation. I might just, you know, take the bribe for the sake of my family and just like shut up, you know? But he refuses to sacrifice his integrity and ends up, you know, sacrificing 17 years of his life instead. And I think the other one is with Charles Darnay, who when like the French Revolution and the Reign of Terror is like first breaking out, he gets a letter from an old friend who was, you know, kind of the attendant to his uncle, the Marquis, who is drawn, like, pulled into, like, the drama of all this, and he's afraid that he's going to be killed for good reason, and Charles Darnay sacrifices everything to go over to Paris, and is basically prepared to sacrifice his life, and that's why Charles Darnay is in the whole, like, situation in the first place.
Yeah. There's a couple other themes. One of them you already touched on quite a bit is the theme of class, like social inequality and class conflict. And then also really tied in with that is violence. How like social inequality leads to violence both in the upper class and in the lower class. Like cruel violence, careless, brute, disgusting violence of like the, like what did the Marquis Saint-Evremond, after he ran over the child, he like said, I would squash any one of you. And it like, I wouldn't bat an eye, or I would still be able to sleep at night or something.
Yeah, he's basically like, after the kid is dead, he's like, great, like one less of you going around or whatever.
Yeah. Where it's just like this large gap between the upper and lower class robs both the upper and lower class of a sense of humanity in the eyes of the other.
Right.
Like the upper class sees the lower class as scum and villainy and like pests that like the world would be better if we rid ourselves of them. And the lower class sees the upper class as parasites and vermin.
Monsters, basically.
That's like the world would be better if we rid ourselves of them. And so it's interesting that like obviously this is the story was a critique of those like late stage capitalists. It's me again. What I meant to say was late stage feudalist, because the French Revolution, one of the whole points was to overthrow feudalism and implement capitalism. So it was the late stage feudalism class gap that I was referring to. Class separations, but also it wasn't really pro-revolutionary at this either. It was talking about like this was my interpretation of it, where it was like there's always like the imminent possibility of a revolution, but there wasn't an inherent morality to either side. The revolutionaries weren't the inherent like moral figures.
Right. I really liked how I loved that portrayal of how it just showed that like, yeah, both sides were like prone to violence for different reasons, and like neither side was better for it. Like, you know, I think the upper class was pretty much monsters, like kind of like they were portrayed. I think like the way that they were treating others was like very despicable, but then the way that the like lower class just starts indiscriminately killing everyone that they think might have some tangential relation to the ruling class, and like don't care, they just are out for blood. I think that was like another great portrayal, how like they showed like they didn't care that Charles Darnay had like renounced his fortune long ago and was like living on his own and like living a good life and was a good man, and they wanted to go after him, and they wanted to go after Lucy and her daughter because they were related to him.
Mm-hmm.
And it had nothing to do with anything that they'd done, but like who they just happened to be born into. And I think like it does a great job of portraying that.
Yeah, I think very closely tangentially related to that is also the theme of justice, where in general, justice is this very pure kind of monumentalized, is that a word? Like justice
very
is
idealized.
Yeah. Justice is this like concept that in literature, media is almost always put on a pedestal as like something good. And I feel like this story kind of makes the point that the like search for justice, or the attempt to find justice or create justice, is so easily corrupted by both sides. And I think that's so eloquently illustrated in the fact that Charles Darnay is put on trial two times, once by the upper class and once by the lower class. And both times he's really innocent. And so like whether it's the ruling class that is seeking justice or whether it's the lower class revolutionaries that are seeking justice, either way, there's flaws in their system of like and their motivations of like finding true justice. And so it's like this ideal like hope that can never truly and honestly be realized.
Yeah, I think that's very well put. All right, last question. How does this compare to other musicals that you've seen or listened to in terms of style, storytelling, and overall experience?
Okay, style and storytelling, I already mentioned how it reminds me so much of Les Mis, just set in 18th/19th century France.
Based on a classic novel written
by either Charles Dickens or Victor Hugo.
Right. One is British, one is French.
Uh-huh. And I love Les Mis. I can't remember if I had seen... So Les Mis is something where I've read the book, I've seen the movie, like one of... I mean, there's several movie adaptations, but one of the movie adaptations based on the book, I've also seen one of the movie adaptations based on the Broadway musical, and I've seen the musical on Broadway when I was in New York back in 2016, I want to say, which was right before I think it closed. I think it closed around that time on Broadway. Mm-hmm. And I just... That's a story where I think it's such a like character. I mean, most musicals are character driven stories, but that one just has so many characters that all have such complex motivations. And like also Javert in Les Mis, like, is entirely driven by this blinded desire for justice that he has no compassion. Whereas you contrast that with Jean Valjean, who his entire motivation is acting on compassion for others who are in hard situations, even if that means navigating around justice. And so I think though, like, it has very like similar like style and thematic beats to A Tale of Two Cities. And so I think that's one thing, is I was just expecting it to be too much like Les Mis that it left me confused. But now I think going back to it, I would have a much greater appreciation for it. I think it's very different musically than a lot of the musicals that I've seen recently. It's a lot more similar to like something like Phantom of the Opera, where it's more like classical, not antiquated, but like older style of musical.
Right.
Whereas like Hadestown was very folksy. Hamilton's very like is another one that we have listened to recently, and that's obviously very more contemporary style. And
yeah, I think there's been. And like this has to go with like broader trends that like I've noticed on Broadway, but like recently there's been a trend towards more contemporary music with less of an orchestra, just because they don't want to pay, like, you know, margins are getting thinner on Broadway. So there's like that business aspect of it. So they're like, you know, Tale of Two Cities is made with like a full orchestra, like Phantom of the Opera, and they just want to pay like less musicians and stuff. And so I think it was kind of one of the last of its era, and that they've all just kind of been like getting more contemporary and smaller musician groups and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, temporary musicals have been around a while for sure. Like Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, like how all of the music there is like very stylized contemporary, but.
Right. But more so lately.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Where it's, I think like the rise of the jukebox musicals, yes, and pop musicals, like this is not jukebox, not pop, yeah, in any sense of the word.
The explosion of jukebox musicals.
Yeah. And the explosion of musicals based on
movies. Yeah.
I mean, this is like, I'm sure there's a movie about the Tale of Two Cities, probably several, but it's not like, we're talking like Shrek the musical, Mean Girls the musical, Legally Blonde. Back to the Future.
Yeah.
Yeah. What about you? What are your like connections to other works of fiction or musicals? How do you relate it to
yeah,
other
I mean, obviously, the obvious connection here is Les Mis, but I never really had that deep of a connection with Les Mis. Like,
I don't think you had seen it all the way through until our honeymoon, right?
No, we never watched it all the way through on our honeymoon. I did watch the movie, like the recent one with Hugh Jackman and Amanda Seyfried and Russell Crowe. I saw that one.
Sacha Baron Cohen.
Yes. I mean, we can list off a bunch of actors.
Eddie Redmayne.
Yeah, that whole production is star-studded. But I saw that movie once all the way through in high school. I know it was like a classic musical that a lot of people loved. And my family, like, I think I just grew up with like the women in my family always kind of like talking down about it, because I don't think they fully loved the themes of prostitution, even though like Les Mis does not portray prostitution in like a glamorous light or anything, but it's just like a lot seedier than like the types of musicals that my family, like the women in my family, like traditionally listened to and liked. And so, because they, you know, they, I grew up with the classics like Oklahoma, Singing in the Rain, like all very like upbeat, like South Pacific, all very like upbeat, like happier musicals. The stage production of Oklahoma aside, I can go on a rant about that one, but that's a whole other story. But, you know, they just never really loved Les Mis because of, you know, the whole like prostitution aspect of it. And just because of like how dark it was. And so I always was just like, oh, well, it's like a bad musical. Like I just had this like mental like context of it being like a quote unquote like bad musical or whatever. And I watched the movie and like it was fine. But I think because of like that thought, I just kind of like purposefully like didn't connect with it while I watched it. And I think like I've listened to like the music, like I've heard the music like a little bit more, and I would like connect with it more if I like listen to it now. But yeah, I think like Les Mis is like the obvious connection, even though it wasn't like very much of a connection to me because it's not really beloved to me yet. And just kind of like those like more classic musicals. I think one of the things that I really love that Jill Santoriello does with the music is that all of like the peasants' music when they're singing is done in like a 6/8 or like a 12/8, like music with like a triplet backbeat as opposed to just like the one and two and that like you normally hear with that's like more typical in music and that like the rest of the musical is in. And I think it just kind of like provides a stark contrast. And it's interesting because normally like, and this is like my music nerd coming out, but like normally songs with like that triplet backbeat are more kind of like upbeat and bouncy, or they're more like swung and like jazzy, but this is like very dark. And I think it's really masterful that she like uses something that's normally more like bouncy and upbeat to make it like dark and like the dark themes for the peasants of the musical, which I think is just very well done the way that she does it. That didn't really answer the question, but
I was going to say, there's that one song where the ensemble, I mean, it's not the peasants in the ensemble, but when they're singing in the first trial where they're like, hooray for truth and justice. Like, that's very like, like 4/4. So.
Yeah, yeah. But that's like, that's in Britain and that's right. Not like the French peasants.
Oh, I see.
No, I'm talking about, and these are some
Wait, so is that, did they put like mainly like the duple meter in Britain and the triple meter in France?
Yeah.
That is, I didn't notice that. I'll have to pay. That's a really cool, like, mm-hmm. like musical distinction to make, like, between the two cities. I didn't notice that, but I'll have to pay attention to that.
And I don't think it's, like, hard fast. I don't think it's like a super hard fast rule because there's that song Little Ones that's like very clearly in 4/4 and that's kind of it's split between Britain and France. Like in Britain you've got like Sydney and Charles kind of lamenting like this, it's when they first get the news of like the French Revolution like breaking out in Paris, and like Sydney and Charles are lamenting like the little girl being raised in like this tumultuous world and stuff that she shouldn't have to deal with, and Charles thinking about how he's gonna go help his friend. And but then at the same time, you've got France, it's right after the little boy had been run over and it's the funeral procession for him. And so it's not like a super hard, fast rule. But when the peasants are, when it's like purely like a peasant song, like the opening theme, the way it ought to be, it is in 6/8. And I think it's just such a cool choice that she does. And also like very cool that she's able to make this upbeat, normally like very happy. Like you think of like 6/8, that's going to be like your, some of those like sailors tunes and stuff that are just kind of like, you know, like happy or whatever, but she makes it very dark. And I think it's really cool, and also cool that she like uses those meters to like contrast the two cities.
That is awesome. Yeah, I the first song, The Way It Ought to Be, is 12/8. So
yeah, The Way It Ought to Be, and then kind of that song in the middle or like near the end where they're doing like the farcical play and stuff. That's one of my favorite of the whole musical. And like, I don't even like really know why, because it's not like a particular standout compared to like some of the others. But oh, I don't know if it's in that book.
Until Tomorrow is in 9-8.
Yeah. And Until Tomorrow is the other one that is done by the peasants, but it's right after Until Tomorrow. I think it's called Wait Ought to Be Reprise. Let me look it up real quick.
Then Without a Word is in Cut Time.
But that's not.
Right.
And that's Lucy singing in England.
So yeah, that's just the contrast of like these complex like triple meter. And then yeah, Let Her Be a Child is in 12-8. Man, that's cool. I never noticed it. And then the finale is in Cut Time.
Let's see. Everything Stays the Same. That's the one that I'm thinking of.
Oh, yeah, I remember that one. Yeah.
That's one of my favorite when they're like doing the play, like King Louis and his Austrian whore, Marie Antoinette. Like, I love that one. But yeah, that one's, I want to say that one's in 12-8. Or maybe it's in 6-8. It's hard to tell the difference. What happened to tomorrow? Tell us just who's to blame.
It might be 12-8. 10, 10, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12.
They come and they go, and everything stays the same. Yeah. It's hard to tell the difference between 12-8 and 6-8 sometimes. Yeah. But
same, like, it used to be hard for me to tell the difference between 3-4 and 6-8. But I'm like, because it could either be 1, 2, 3, or 1 and 2, or 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Like,
but yeah, if you can just like find like the downbeats, I think the difference becomes pretty clear between the two.
Cool.
Yeah, I think it's just one of those choices that's like very subtle, but makes a huge difference.
That's awesome. Like, that is really cool. I'm excited to pay attention to upon further revisits to this. So,
yeah. Well, Josh, any final thoughts that you have, your takeaways from this? Would you recommend it to others?
I don't know that a lot of people know about this. Like, I don't think it was on Broadway for a long time, right?
No, like
it was in
maybe
2006
a year.
Or 2007. I was.
And it didn't have like huge names in it either.
It's like I had, because after we had saw it and I was still trying to figure out like, man, why, what was it that made it so that I didn't like it? I had asked this Discord server that I'm in. I'm like, has anybody else seen the A Tale of Two Cities musical? And everyone was like, I had no idea that that was a thing. Like, so I would definitely recommend, if, especially if you have read the Charles Dickens book and enjoyed the story, then you would really like the musical, I think. And then if you are a fan of like historical fiction and like those styles of musicals like Les Mis, then yeah, like Phantom, like then you would really like this, I think.
Okay, you know how I just said there weren't really any big names in it? I just looked it up. Bryce Dallas Howard was in it when they were like workshopping it.
Oh, no way.
She was the seamstress who's like the lady that sings at the end with Sidney Carton as he's like waiting to be.
Oh, yeah.
Like they're both waiting to be called up to be killed. But yeah, she was in it. That's crazy. But yeah, it's definitely one of the lesser known musicals. Like I said, it's not like the great, like I don't think it like should have had like a 25-year run on Broadway like Phantom has, but I definitely don't think it gets the attention that it deserves, because I do think it's very good and very well done, and just no one's ever heard of it.
I agree. Any other final thoughts?
Just that it's great. Like, and I think, you know, part of that, like how it's not really known, I think, you know, one of the things they were talking about when the director came out is how like Utah has kind of become this like weird, almost like hotspot for this musical where it's like done over and over again. Like that was my third time seeing it, a third different company, theater company within Utah that I've seen that has done it. And I know like some of the theater companies have done it multiple times. And it's just like interesting that this has like become like a local favorite here in like the theater scene in Utah that like not a lot of other people. I don't think it's as known outside of Utah.
I think he said that the creator, Jill Santoriello, loves producing the shows in Utah productions specifically.
Yeah, I know like one time I saw it in high school at a theater company that is just in the next town from the one that I grew up in. And she was doing like a Q&A, and I was really into, like, I was taking my music theory class at the time, like my AP music theory class. I was really into the composition of it. I really wanted to go, but it also just happened to fall on my cousin's baby shower that morning. So I like couldn't go to it, but she does do a lot of stuff locally out here, which is very interesting.
Do you think she lives in Utah?
No, I think she lives in New York.
Gotcha.
But I think she just comes out here a lot because we're the ones that have kept her show alive.
That's interesting.
It is.
I feel so bad that I like had such a negative reaction. Jill, if you're listening to this, I promise that it was a good show and that I'm excited to see it again. I'm just a sad little boy with some difficulties sometimes. And
I know. I was sad about it, too, because I wanted to go up and talk to her and, like, tell her how much of an impact this show has had on me and how much of a respect I had for her as a composer and a writer. But kind of after your reaction, I just, like, made a beeline for the car.
Yeah. Hopefully she's at the show next time.
Yeah.
I'm sure she will be, so.
Yeah. Anyways, well, Josh, why don't you take us out?
All right. This has been another episode of Thanks for Participating. I've been Josh, and I've been joined by my lovely co-host / spousal equivalent, Sydney. And once again,
one of these days we're gonna have to tell the spousal equivalent joke.
Yeah,
but not today.
Mm-hmm. Sorry listeners that you cannot be my spousal equivalent, only Sydney can. And once again, thanks for listening. You can find me on Instagram at josh_is_rich or Sydney at dipyourchicken. You can find the show on Instagram and TikTok at tfp_pod or on Twitter at tfp_show. You can also support the show by ordering some podcast merch. The link to our TeePublic store is in the show notes. Send mail to participating.podcast@gmail.com, which I forgot to mention on the last episode. the last episode we did, I'll probably throw it in there. But if you have recommendations, like based on like listening to the things that we talk about and you're like, oh, if he liked this, didn't like this, and you have recommendations for things for us to check out, definitely send us recommendations for things. Shows, movies, books, music, anything. Please rate and review the show on iTunes / Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you find a place to rate and review. That helps the show a ton. Cover art is by Vaishon Brandon. Find him on Instagram at Vaishon Designs. Our music is by Mitch Fry at Firefry_ on Instagram and Mitch Fry Music on YouTube.
And as always, we love you listeners and thank you for participating.
And thank you for not sending me to the Bastille for 17 years. All right, talk to you next time.